Our next speaker, Martin Williams, I introduced at the New York conference with a long list of his published titles. Today, perhaps I'll just say that he's a well-known and highly esteemed writer, critic, and historian on the subject of jazz, and at present is acquisitions editor of the Smithsonian Institution Press. Very pleased that Martin Williams will speak to us today on the development of Sarah Vaughan's voice. Martin Williams.
Thank you. Since people think of me as a jazz person, I'm going to ad lib on the subject of Sarah Vaughan's voice. And if anybody wants a checklist, by the way, of what I'm going to play, it is back there in the back, but not by record label. See, I don't believe in that. I think if you like this, you'll go find the record. Now, how do I...
Just
that way? Okay, I'm all set. I would ordinarily try to start a thing like this by playing music. I think that's the best way, but I won't exactly. Carl was kind enough and foolish enough to say something about broad vision. Well, the broad we're going to vision here is Sarah Vaughan. I can't resist those things. And I'll give you a brief history. She was born and raised in Newark, New Jersey, where she sang in a church choir. And I think it's important to know that this was the kind of black church in a northern city which was more apt to hire someone to come in and train the choir to do a Bach chorale than to try to develop its own gospel style of singing. And there are and always have been such churches. But what that says about her is that she was, to a certain extent, a trained musician. She also is an accomplished pianist and does a very difficult thing of accompanying herself. Now, that's not so hard for many cocktail pianists to do, and many others, but it is difficult when you are doing the kind of thing vocally that she does. It becomes very difficult. I'm not going to play an example of self-accompaniment. I just want to give you that as a part of the background picture. She, like a lot of other people of whom you've heard, most outstandingly, Ella Fitzgerald, she won a Harlem Apollo Theater amateur contest. And during the Second World War, she joined the Earl Hines Band as the featured singer. She also spelled the leader, who was a pianist after all, at the keyboard frequently, and she was even given, I'm told, in some live performances, a solo spot on piano, which was very kind of her, all things considered. The other singer with the orchestra at that point was Billy Eckstein. That orchestra, during her period there, also had a number of the young Turks of what came to be known as bebop, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, and so forth. And it's one of the great losses to recorded history in American music that orchestra never made commercial records, and furthermore, no air shots, no off-the-air recordings of that group have ever been found. That is another kind of loss. When Eckstein broke away and formed his own orchestra, she was his singer as well. She went with him, and a lot of those young musicians, including Parker and Gillespie, went along too. By the end of the war, it was very evident that this lady was going to have a career on her own as a singer. Just to give you a slight indication of her character, if I had called Ella Fitzgerald abroad and she had known it, she wouldn't like it. But Sarah wouldn't mind my calling her abroad at all. Okay, let's go to a good reason to be interested. I'm going to play your record pretty cold and invite you only to listen particularly for two things. This is a performance of Vincent Newman's More Than You Know, with a lyric by a fellow named Edward Eliscu, of whom you may have heard as a result of the last year's meeting. I think it's one of the outstanding American popular songs, certainly one of Human's great ones, along with Yesterday's. And it is also a song with a verse that's almost as interesting as the song itself. The verse to it, Sarah also sings here. The accompaniment is by Oscar Peterson. Notice two things about this voice: its range, its body, that kind of thing, but the use of vibrato that you hear here, and also do not miss at the conclusion of this thing a really stunning diminuendo. And notice, this is not a matter of an engineer turning down the gain. This is her control of her voice. Okay. I'm sorry about that goof. First of all, I want to acknowledge that these simple tapings directly from LPs were done by Jack Towers. These are my scratchy records, which I'd played too much and which I could get nothing like this out of on my own equipment, so I went to Jack's house, and that's the result. You'd be hearing a lot more noise, and this is simply a matter of his picking the right stylus. I've had the experience often of playing a Cervon recording like that one or another comparable one for people who know vocal technique and who are, let us say, opera fans. And they are simply astonished, of course. But their usual response will be something like, well, why doesn't she study? Or why didn't she study? Of course, the first answer to that is, study what? What would there be for her to study? She has got techniques there that she couldn't study. But the second and more serious, and I mean that question is seriously imposed, the misunderstanding that's involved there is that vocal technique should be used in the manner proper to singing Verdi or Wagner, let us say, and if you use the vocal technique any other way, you're using it wrongly, which of course is a kind of strange assumption, particularly in a country which, like ours, which is developing and needs, heaven knows, its own culture. And that's exactly what she is up to. The other more serious response is, if she wanted to sing like a 19th century Italian, which is a perfectly legitimate thing for someone to want to do, including Shirley Verrett and Leontine Price, then she would study, or she would have studied. But what she wants to do is to sing like a 20th century American. And that, if we really think about it, is an extremely bold, daring, and risky thing to undertake, because no one knows really what it means yet to sing like an American. And like such artists as Fred Astaire, she is exploring what our arts are and can be. People are also assuming with a question like that, why doesn't she learn to sing something artistic? But she has the high privilege of taking anything, not only an outstanding song like that, but perhaps the silliest piece of trash ever written, and making it artistic. And this is not vocal stunt work or trickery. I think you can sense that right away. This is not Ima Sumac. In spite of the fact that she has exactly the same range of baritone through soprano. She has all that range, and it is perfect. And she has that incredible sense of pitch. And she can jump the most difficult interval spontaneously and land true. I don't think I've ever heard her off but once. Ever, just once. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. I don't know many people on the operatic stage or concert stage where the interval is predetermined and right there, and all you got to do is get up there to it or down there to it. Who could say that? Her interval is never predetermined necessarily. Let me just go through a parade of what's involved in this style, just a little bit, because I really can't probe it very far. But that question of vibrato. Vibrato to a classical singer or performer, of course, is a constant. It is this kind of wavering, that wide. Vibrato to Sarah Vaughan is anything from this to that. She has perfect control over all of that range of vibrati. And she uses them, as I'm sure you're well aware by now, as an ornament. Now, I'm convinced, because of work going on here in original instrument performance and so forth, that was the case in European music until the 19th century, and that it should be the case in performance now. But what has happened is for vibrato in that kind of singing and instrumental performance on most instruments, the violin and the strings outstandingly, has become a constant. And perhaps that's a very wrong thing to have happened in music in the interpretation of the 18th and 19th century repertories. That's under serious consideration. In any case, that's how she uses it. You might say that she does not have one voice, but several, because she has developed such a great range of vocal textures, each of which she can call upon. None of this is accident, of course. particularly in the head tones, and that's completely unorthodox. Up here, she has such a range, the notes that come out up here, she has such a range of textures and the control over those textures that it's simply kind of astonishing. I think if we had been living in the 18th century in Italy, for instance, during the development of the bel canto style, when every singer in performance, in opera or any other performance, was required to be spontaneous, was required to show a spontaneity with ornament, was not asked to sing any text literally, was up there to explore both the composition and the voice, it would be something like this experience. Of course, they developed a style that was considerably different in many ways, but that's what she's doing every night, finding out, exploring her voice and her material constantly. And as I say, that was once a requirement. Perhaps some of us tend to forget, and this is something that I only became acquainted with when I started thinking about her and tried to find out something about European vocal history, and I may have it wrong, and I may have it carelessly put together, but I think it is generally acknowledged that what happened there was that the singers explored the possibility of voice, of the human voice, and the composers came along and used that exploration in their composition by the time you got to 19th century opera and Lieder. And, well, here's all this raw material for us in a voice like hers. But there is another element there that I mustn't abandon, and that is that in this country, and particularly in her idiom of music, one cannot be a great artist by imitating anyone else. That's not possible. Not only did Fred Astaire have to learn what it means to dance like an American, he had to learn what it means to dance like an American named Fred Astaire. The same with this lady. The same with Duke Ellington as a composer. You can learn from all of your fellow performers, but you cannot imitate. Gene Kelly could not have had a career if he'd been the best imitator of Fred Astaire that anyone could imagine. That wouldn't mean anything. And yet you could have a considerable career in classic ballet by being the best imitator of somebody. I think that's worth remembering. In that sense, I think that these forms of culture that I'm mentioning here are truly democratic. I don't use that in a populist sense, but I use it in that sense. It requires the individual's discovery of his or her own talent, of his or her own way of doing things. Okay, let's go through a little of this history and try to find out how this remarkable thing came about as reflected on recordings. This is one of the earliest recordings she made. She made this while she was a singer with Billy Eckstein's orchestra. By the time that Eckstein had formed this orchestra, the band, the union, and the musicians' union ban on recordings was no longer in force. Major labels had not signed, but smaller labels had, and the Eckstein Orchestra made recordings for two small labels, created especially in this crisis, by the way, and during the war. But Servan did not record with the orchestra. There were several reasons for that. One of them is that the record producers said things like, well, you know, if a guy goes and puts a nickel in a jukebox to hear Billy Eckstein's orchestra, he wants to hear Billy Eckstein. He doesn't want to hear an instrumental, and he doesn't want to hear another singer. The other reason being, and this is a little less kind in its implications, Billy Eckstein didn't want her to record. He didn't mind the fellowship and the competition and the healthy competition of her on the bandstand and the compliment to him as a leader that existed in that. She did record one piece. He happened to be the composer of that piece. I wonder how that came about. Anyway, while she was with him, she did this kind of thing. This is one of the first, and this is mean to me, here with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie in a small group. And Gillespie was the guy who promoted this record, by the way, and saw to it that she got to make it. I guess I've screwed up again. I'm not getting anything out of this. Oh, here we go, here we go, here we go. Sorry.
You love who's in me, I don't know why I did it.
Here's the same song as she recorded it 5 years later, but I'm playing only the final chorus on this recording. This is 1950. That was 45. This is 50. Now, she is now off on her own, and she's recording for a major label in this case, Columbia. And this particular chorus I'm going to play is very celebrated for the fact that, except for a little tameness in the bridge of that song, she is improvising a melody for of her own. Some of it echoes the little tag that you just heard, to be sure. But she's doing, as a singer, but using the lyric, what the horn men were doing. She's not scatting here. She's not humming. She is using these words, and she's tied to them, but improvising a completely original melody in the A phrases of this piece. We still have not, you will notice, still here, we haven't opened up the voice. That's another subject that I wish somebody would research. Something happened to popular singing of all kinds in this country in the middle 50s. Singers stopped crooning and started singing out. Listen to the difference between Ella Fitzgerald on Decca and Ella Fitzgerald on Verve. The difference between Frank Sinatra on Columbia and Frank Sinatra on Capitol. And so on and on and on. Now, why that happened and how it happened, I'm not sure. I got a couple of theories. But it certainly happened to Sarah Vaughan, and it certainly brought about a great change. However, it hadn't happened at this point. But listen to this as a horn improvisation. But remember, she's got that, they got those words to deal with still. Incidentally, the trumpet obbligato in that first half of that was played by some kid named Miles Davis. Didn't amount to much after that, I'm afraid. Never heard from again. Now, if you know, if some scholar came along in 50 years and heard those two things 5 years apart, he would say something about, my goodness, what a remarkable development that went on there in just those 5 years, how much she learned to handle her voice as an improvising instrument, modeling herself on the saxophonist and the trumpeters and so forth. But that would be an assumption that one really should not make, because during those 5 years, as I say, there were no commercial recordings made. However, in the same year as the first one, there is this broadcast by the Eckstein Orchestra, fortunately made for the Armed Forces Radio Service, and recently within the last 5 years, revealed on that show called Jubilee. And lo and behold, in an Eckstein appearance on that show, Sarah Vaughan sings Mean to Me.
Why must you be mean to me?
Something worth remembering when you hear a thing like that, I think. Consider how many people hearing that in 1945 and hearing that already astonishing voice, far beyond anything singing with an American dance orchestra, would have said, how many liberals would have said, with the best intentions in the world, isn't it a shame that she has to sing with a dance band? It's only because she's black. If she weren't, she could have a career at the Met. Think about the implications of that kind of remark in a broader context than in a kind of self-righteousness that's involved in making that remark. She didn't choose to, she wouldn't have chosen to sing at the Met. That's very clear. She chose to do what she has done with her voice and her career. And it's, in my estimation, obviously, very significant what she's done. Very significant for this country's culture. During the 50s, she was a successful singer in certain kinds of clubs. She was not, as she is today, invited to sing in almost any hall in the world with almost any orchestra and in almost any setting that she wishes. But she was making the jazz clubs, and at that point there were a lot of them, and she was making other kinds of venue like Las Vegas. Gradually she broke into that. She was recording in two settings. One were the recordings that the jazz fans liked, her singing with a trio improvisationally. The other were studio-made records with orchestras, usually string-oriented, typical of the string writing of that time. Not very good, I'm afraid. But on those recordings, which had more commercial intention on the part of the producers and perhaps Servon herself, you do hear the voice opening up in ways that it was not doing on the jazz records. Not improvisationally, just in a matter of volume, texture, dynamics, and that kind of thing. And here's one of those. This is this remarkable Richard Rodgers, Larry Hart song called Little Girl Blue, recorded in 1959. And the arrangement and the conductor here, the guy named Hal Mooney, who now works pulling accompaniments for TV shows out at MCA Universal in Hollywood, by the way.
When I was very young,
Jazz singers are, of course, noted, and jazz players too, of course, noted for being able to make something wonderful out of ordinary material. That lady can make something wonderful out of ordinary arranging as well by knowing how to get in and out of it and to supply and hold that note just like. There are so many singers and so many musics in the world who would benefit by having that sense of musical phrase, which is just a part of her equipment, just, you know, as it might be to a composer. But that's a requirement in her idiom of music. Wouldn't it be lovely someday if we could have a performance of, let us say, Porgy and Bess, in which every singer on the stage was capable of that kind of spontaneity, but sticking, of course, to the drama at the same time? Wouldn't that be something to hear? Maybe that's really what Gershwin hoped for. That might happen someday, because he was surrounded by people who, although they did not have this kind of voice and this kind of improvisational ability, had all of that in small measure. And he knew the implications of that very well, I'm sure. Should I play one more thing? I ask for questions. Or just stop? All right, may I, you know, I was about to play you something a little more up in an Ella Fitzgerald type mood, but I won't. So, yes,
Mark,
David.
A naive question.
No, I doubt it.
You were mentioning about Porgy and Bess.
Yeah.
What about that old Bethlehem record, which was in the 10th, I think, in that period?
Yeah.
Or was this a strictly...
Well, you mean the Mel Torme, what was her name? Danny Kaye's sister. Yeah.
Well, in any case, what I remember, I still have the record somewhere in my collection.
Yeah, certainly.
There was an attempt to do a Porgy and Bess in a jazz spirit.
Yes. There is also a recording by her from this year with the same kind of writing behind it, I'm afraid, a rewriting of Gershwin of I Loves You, Porgy. With her singing it. It is simply astonishing. No, I'm sorry. My man's gone now. It is just mind-blowing for her part of it. Yes, yes, sir, Michael.
I found it interesting that when she did the South Pacific last year.
Yeah.
but I found that interesting in that this was a case in that recording where it was not really something that you would have expected for a Broadway show album. Once again, this she gave her own interpretation of the song rather than Bloody Mary's interpretation of the song. And so in a sense, if she really wanted to get rid of that jazz label, she would have sung the song straight as Rogers had written the melody. But she did do maybe not as much improvisation as on some of the ones we have played before. But she did, you know, veer quite a distance away from the melody in some cases.
Yeah, well, I
the jazz to become more serious, thought of as a serious singer?
She's not serious?
No, I mean a serious...
I heard what you said. You mean she's not serious? I think she's enormously serious. I can't respond, Michael, I can't respond to that. I don't know what that means. She did not do that role appropriately. Okay, she didn't. I agree with you. It was not expected that she would be cast in the part. Has she ever done anything expected? I don't know. It wasn't expected, no. I wouldn't have cast her in the part. I'd have written a show she could carry and do what she did. Yeah. Yeah.
I would, as they say, make a fire and say that he is trying to transcend.
Exactly, exactly. She has more vocal equipment and more vocal technique at her command than it takes to sing Puccini and Wagner put together, and maybe Richard Strauss as well. I submit that to you. I know what you meant, sir.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Want to take one more question?
Yes. Only as a member of the choir. This is all self-exploration. Who could teach her to do this? What would be, that's the significance of this in part, it seems to me. No one, no vocal coach, no teacher would have the standards that she is discovering to teach her to do what she's discovered as her technique. As far as I know, she has never had any even vocal coaching. But she is a trained musician in the sense that she plays piano, she has perfect pitch, she can play very good piano, actually, and she sang in that choir, she could read those choir parts, she can read anything, apparently, if she wants to. That's all I know about that question.